I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. And 2013 was quite an important year for 13 New Hampshire towns, which observed their Sester Centennials, or 250th anniversary. It's a milestone that, in many communities, was celebrated with events chock full of rich stories about the Granite State's past. And so, Exchange executive producer Keith Shields went out to learn more about these towns, what led them to be granted their charters in the first place, how they got their names and their boundaries, what fueled their economies, and those superlative facts about each that are often forgotten. For example, how an 83-foot redstone rocket ended up in the town center of Warren, why Haverhill became the world's leading manufacturer of whetstones, and when Lisbon cornered the global market on piano sounding boards and shoe pegs. And there are other unique stories, that New Boston has one of the oldest pieces of artillery still in use, and that acid rain was discovered in Thornton. But these 250th anniversaries reveal more than just these, gee, I didn't know that moments. As a group, these towns unveil a history of the Granite State, the industries that fueled our economy, from sheep to shoes to mining, and the forces behind population spikes of the early 19th century and the extreme depopulation as that century closed. Today in The Exchange, NHPR series 250 Years in the Making. Let's hear from you. If you're from one of these 13 towns profiled, what insight did you gain from your Sester Centennial? If you're from a city or town preparing for an upcoming major birthday, what are your hopes for that event? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. With me in studio, Keith Shields, executive producer of The Exchange, and as I said, reporter for the 250 Years in the Making series. And Keith, congratulations, you're almost done. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Stu Wallace, New Hampshire historian and history professor at NHTI. And Stu, it's been a while. Welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Marcia Schmidt-Blaine, professor of history at Plymouth State University. And Marcia, as I understand, featured in the story this morning about Thornton. Good to have you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Keith, I want to start with you, but obviously hear from our historians as well. Where did this whole idea come from, Keith? Sester Centennials.
Sesquicentennial. Yeah, it actually came from a former producer of The Exchange, Ty Fraley, who worked on the show about 5 years ago. He's now the communications director for the Department of Tourism. And he sent me an email one day. He said, hey, did you know that there's 13 towns in New Hampshire turning 250? And, you know, we talked about it as an exchange series, and we thought, well, maybe not an hour for every town, but definitely there's a story there. And, you know, we passed it by the news director, Sarah Ashworth. She loved it, and we started working on it. And, you know, I have to say, and, you know, I worked first with Stu on this and then with Marcia as well, that, you know, we looked at these towns at first, and they're like, oh, these are big towns. These are Thornton and Gilsum, the tiny towns, 900 people, 1,000 people. What is there really that you can tell? And then you start unearthing these stories after stories after stories, these superlative things that happen in these little towns. And it became fascinating to learn all about what were happening in these towns over the 250 years.
Yeah, amazing stories. So many, gee, I didn't know that moments, Keith. And we'll definitely get to that. But Stu Wallace, let's focus in on the year 1763 for just a moment. I mean, what makes that such an interesting year?
Well, it was the end of the French and Indian War, and for the first time, the French were now exiting North America, and so that's a good thing. And if you take a look at what population numbers we have, whenever there was a major Indian war, I guess they call them white men wars, whenever there was a major Indian war, population dropped, frontier settlement dropped dramatically. And with 1763, not only was it the end of a war, but it meant for the first time that the French in New France and Acadia were now out of the picture. And so the frontier was now wide open, and the population was such that it was ready for a big jump.
And who was that population, Stu?
Well, the population at that time was largely English, Scottish, a smattering of Irish here and there. And it was primarily a Protestant population. We were very much of a Protestant state at that time.
And it made it safe then. Once the French and Indian Wars were over, people said, you know, I was thinking about moving to New Hampshire, didn't feel very good about it, and now I can.
Yeah, seacoast area in the southern part of the state was beginning to explode, literally. It had reached the point of what we call now demographic maturity. I'm not sure why that term, but it meant that they had reached the point where they had stretched their economy and their food supply and everything else to the point where they had to take a growth. They had to get out into the frontier, and now the frontier was safe.
Yeah, what do you think, Marcia? Add into 1763, what makes that so important or such a pivotal year?
It was a seminal year. One of the things that Stu has touched on, of course, is the fact that it's the end of the French and Indian Wars, and the Indians are no longer something that the settlers needed to be as afraid of as they had been before. They were worried about constant attacks that were coming from the French and the Indians. So suddenly all those people, not only in southern New Hampshire, but also in Massachusetts, Connecticut, even parts of Rhode Island, could come north. And north was a place that people were attracted to. So lots of farmers started pouring into northern New Hampshire.
What was it that attracted him? You said farmers.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
You know, usually we don't think of northern New Hampshire as being an attractive place
to
farmers.
Well, that's why I'm asking, yes.
Yeah, we think of crops of rocks, et cetera. But the northern New Hampshire had a lot of very good land, and we often forget about that. And it is the south-facing slopes that farmers wanted to be on. So there are lots and lots of slopes. For instance, Sandwich, New Hampshire was one of the ones that was featured in this particular series, attracted a lot of people who wanted to live in an area that was good for farming. As the population was exploding, somebody had to feed them. So all these farmers who moved north now had a ready market, and as more people came along, as they did, because the population truly did explode, particularly between 1790 and 1830, they needed farmers to be able to do that. And northern New Hampshire was one of the places that exported a lot of food.
Yeah, and people didn't know yet how good the land was out west. So
true.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Another thing that's interesting to me about this particular year, Keith Shields, 1763, is Governor Benning Wentworth. In your series, Dartmouth historian Jerry Daniel calls him one shrewd dude.
He really was. He was a fascinating person. You know, the thing I learned about Benning Wentworth, not only was he the longest provincial governor in New Hampshire, but he was actually the longest provincial governor of any colony before, you know, independence. And he was such a wheeler and a dealer. He knew how to make the people in England happy, and he knew how to make the people in New Hampshire happy. And, you know, one of the things, a couple other things that were happening in this year, and it's funny, it have this little perfect storm of activity, is that, for one, that King George III was in. And he was a little worried about losing his job.
And Wentworth
was worried about losing his job. And so he kind of decided that he was going to create this little legacy for himself and start granting out these talents to people that would make him happy so he could walk away saying that I did a good job as a governor. And then the other thing is there was a border dispute right then, the east-west border between kind of New York and New Hampshire, which included Vermont. And so it was kind of like at the time, they had to, you know, they were starting to grab those towns as ownership, you know, kind of ownership is, what do they say? Property is whatever the law.
A large chunk of the law. Yeah,
exactly. So they started saying, okay, these are for New Hampshire. And so it was this border dispute that was going on about where those towns of Vermont actually lie. Do they lie in New Hampshire or do they lie in New York?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we forget that early in New Hampshire's history, there was a lot of fighting with our neighbors who now we have, of course, terrific relations with. I want to raise one of those stories that exemplifies just what you talked about, Keith. This is from your piece on Alstead, where, you know, there was a lot of funny business about which towns were in which state.
The town never felt very connected to its provincial New Hampshire government, all the way on the other side of the state in Exeter. To send representatives there was an ordeal. Plus, Stuart Wallace says Alstead felt it had much more in common with its western neighbor.
They used a rationale that was derived by a Dartmouth history professor that since the towns in the western part of the state were not part of the original New Hampshire that was granted to John Mason back in the 1620s, they were in a state of nature and hence could form any kind of government they wanted. And so they rebelled. And Alstead would have been one of those 36 towns that said, we're not part of New Hampshire anymore.
And Cheshire County, New Hampshire became Washington County, Vermont. But officials in Exeter didn't agree with the secession and wanted those towns back. According to Alan Rumrill, executive director of the Historical Society of Cheshire County, what happened next was complete pandemonium.
Some towns joined both Vermont and New Hampshire. Each county elected a sheriff in exactly the same area who went out and arrested each other. So there was great upheaval and controversy. And finally, George Washington himself put an end to it. He sent a letter up to Vermont saying, you have to give up your claim to New Hampshire or we will not consider statehood for Vermont.
Stu Wallace, I just love that little piece there. And George Washington had to come in and stop the squabbling.
Well, that finally did it. We actually had to send 1,000 troops out to the western part of the state when we were supposed to be fighting the British. And we had to send the troops out to try to rein in these states that are these towns that refused to pay taxes and refused basically any kind of civil compliance with the government in Exeter.
Yeah, and Exeter was the capital, too. I had forgotten about that, Marcia. I thought at one point Portsmouth was the capital.
Oh, Portsmouth was the capital during the colonial period. It was a dangerous place, though, right on the seacoast during the Revolution. Exeter became a more logical place, a little more protected.
Okay, and then Concord became the capital
and
at some
Concord.
Point.
Well, they went back and forth for quite a while between Exeter and Concord.
Yeah, and how did the northern towns that are more your expertise, Marcia, feel in terms of the capitals of Exeter and Concord? Did they also feel the same disconnect that the folks in Alstead did?
No, they really didn't. They relied upon the government wherever it was. As long as you're talking about towns that are not along the Connecticut River Valley, once you hit the Connecticut River Valley, there is a disconnect. They're quite different towns. I think one of the things we also forget is how geographically diverse New Hampshire is.
Yeah. One more question about Governor Wentworth before we go into the break. He shields. He played a big role in these towns getting their charters. I love the story about how, okay, I may be out of here, but I want to have a legacy. And, well, Governor Wentworth, if you're listening, it worked. But he also played a role in how these towns were named.
That's right. You know, most of the towns, they need to have at least Governor Wentworth's approval. A lot of these towns, you know, these were named after places in England or people in England, like Sandwich was named after the Earl of Sandwich, who was actually this liaison between England and New Hampshire. Croydon was named after a suburb of London. Or, you know, sometimes he would just make the grantees happy by saying, you know, this is the town that we lived in Connecticut or in Massachusetts. You know, we'd like to kind of bring that up here, and Governor Wentworth would say okay to that. But he had a big influence on, you know, how every town was named, and everything was a shrewd political move.
All right. Well, lots more stories after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. It's all one word, and we'll be right back.
More of the exchange coming up on New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. And time is running out for you to get your name into the drawing to win an iPad Air. Your gift to NHPR right now not only helps to pay for tomorrow's news stories, it also enters you into tomorrow's drawing for as little as $10 or $25 a month. You'll be entered to win the iPad and all the other drawings we have scheduled in the coming days. Make your gift now at nhpr.org or a phone call to 1-888-805-6477. And good luck. New Hampshire weather becoming partly to mostly sunny most of the day today, partly to mostly cloudy from the mountains north, windy, cold, high, single numbers northern Coos County, ranging upper teens in southern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the McLean Law Firm and its family law group for divorce and annulments, prenuptial agreements, adoption, and legal separations online at mclane.com. And Company C, creating a lifestyle of colorful living with brightly colored area rugs, bedding, furniture, and home accents. Retail store in Concord and online at companyc.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the 250th anniversary of 13 New Hampshire towns from 1763 until today. We're looking at a new series by our executive producer, Keith Shields, called 250 Years in the Making. It's on our website, nhpr.org. You can read the series itself, look at some great pictures, and we want to hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. If you live in one of the 13 towns that celebrated its 250th birthday this year, tell us what that celebration meant to you. If you're from a city or town preparing for an upcoming major birthday, what are your hopes for that event? And if you have any questions or comments about what we've learned from this series, about the state overall, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you like, exchange. exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Keith Shields, Stu Wallace, Marcia Schmidt-Blaine, just before the break, we were talking about some of the fights between states, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, how people fought over which towns belonged in which state. Marcia, sometimes in this series, as I learned, there was fighting within the town itself over, you know, which section was going to be part of the town.
Some things don't change, do they, Laura? Certainly we find that back in the colonial period and moving into the 19th century, town boundaries were often, well, they seemed almost amorphous. So if somebody had a center and somebody else decided that they wanted to move to a new section of town and start a new parish, you could also find that that town would suddenly decide that they wanted to be a new town. So we often find that there are a lot of splits going on just within the boundaries as people move and create new towns that came from old towns. I think some of the southern New Hampshire, like New Boston and Candia, are great examples of that, where they broke off from old towns, in part because they couldn't get along with the new towns.
I want to ask Stu and Keith about that, too. But first, just play a little bit from Keith's series, the piece on Haverhill, because for me, that was the standout in terms of, wow, people really have different ideas about where they live and whether that's actually Haverhill or not.
If you ask the person from Haverhill where they're from, you may not get the simple answer you'd expect to get.
If somebody said, where are you from? They'll say, I'm from Woodsville, long before they'll say, I'm from Haverhill. I grew up in Haverhill Corner. It's not just in Haverhill. I grew up in Haverhill Corner. I have to be specific about that, and people from this area understand that.
In fact, there are 7 distinct villages in the town. Included with Woodsville and Haverhill Corner, there's North Haverhill, East Haverhill, Center Haverhill, Pike, and Mountain Lakes. And if that's not complicated enough, lifelong resident Gary Scruton will tell you, it gets worse.
In town, there are 2 separate highway departments. We have 3 fire departments, 4 libraries. There are 5 registered water systems in the town of Haverhill. I haven't figured out a number 6 yet, but there's 7 cemeteries in the town of Haverhill, but only 1 cemetery commission.
Add to that, 4 different post offices and zip codes. That's a lot of diversity for a town with a little more than 4,400 people.
Again, that's a piece from executive producer Keith Shields' series, 250 Years in the Making, looking at the anniversary, 250 years of 13 New Hampshire towns, what those towns learned as they observed this major milestone. We're taking your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Keith, I got to say, when I heard that piece, I thought, wow, really, folks? I mean, it seems repetitive, to say the least.
Well, it's so interesting, and it really is. It's not like I live in Northwood, and so we have Northwood Narrows, we have the Northwood Lake area, but those are just sort of geographical distinctions that explain where in the town you are. These are bona fide, almost kind of self-running places, you know, like Woodsville, that actually formed out of necessity. You know, Woodsville formed because of the railroad that went into there. Pike started because of the whetstones that they started to manufacture. That's where the mining was. You know, North Haverhill was sort of the agricultural and the center of town. So one of the things that you have to think about with this is that generally a town was given, or grantees were given a 6x6 plot of land, square, you know, so 6 miles by 6 miles. And the idea with that is if you put the center of town in the middle, then, you know, 3 miles to get into the center of town, you could probably do that by oxen in a half a day. But, you know, actually, Haverhill actually had a little more added to it, so it's actually 10 miles long. So back before there were trains, it was really tough to get from one place to another. So you really had to form these other kind of areas that kind of almost worked independently. And yet it's so funny because this 250th celebration, they really came together, them along with their sort of neighbors in Vermont, to really have this year-long celebration.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, after almost 19 years doing this show, still sometimes people will call in from a town that I haven't heard of, Keith.
Right.
And then I'll ask, you know, the producers will talk about it afterwards, and one of them will say, well, it's a town, but it's not really a town. It's a part of this other town. So.
Well, you know, another one is actually when we told the story of Lisbon and about the Sugar Hill area, which was the Sugar Hill area at the time, sort of like what side of the tracks you are. And, you know, Lisbon was more of the kind of the industrial part. Sugar Hill was more where the vacation homes were. And at some point in time, you know, this division happened where they went, Sugar Hill seceded and became its own town. So sometimes it's these areas that are just areas that are part of the town and yet really are separate. And then other times, you know, something like this happens, like a secession.
Marcia, jump in and then Stu.
I think one of the other towns you could look at is Sandwich. Sandwich started off as a 6x6. It didn't make it. And so they regranted it. And when they regranted it, they made it this massive town of about 10 miles square.
Sandwich is really big, by the way.
Sandwich is a big town.
One of the largest.
And they have certain areas of town where there are different geographical splits. And you come from that part of town, not necessarily the center. So when you talk about Sandwich, it's another area where there was a split because of the geography in large measure.
Yeah. Stu, go ahead. Your thoughts on this.
Most of our towns, like in the Seacoast area, are actually breakaway towns. Originally, there were only four towns there. Now look at all the number of towns we have because they were just too big geographically.
Breakaway from where?
Breakaway from their hometown. I mean, there was one Hampton. Now there are, I think now there are about six towns that were part of the original Hampton because they were just too big. I studied the Scotch-Irish in Londonderry. Now there are three and parts of a fourth town that were part of the original Londonderry because it was just too big. In other cases, they have not broken away as a separate town, but they have divided themselves into separate little villages. Sheep farming was part of the culprit. They had diversified settlement because of sheep farming, and then when sheep farming collapsed, they kind of moved downhill into one of two, three, four, five, six small villages within these towns. And so it's confusing to out-of-staters coming here to learn, for instance, that Contoocook isn't a town that's part of Hopkinton, and that it's confusing for them to realize there's an east or south or north of something in the town, and is it a separate town or not?
Well, not just to out-of-staters. I've gotten caught by this
no,
myself.
It is confusing, and it gets into this whole question of post offices, libraries, whatever.
Yeah. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, a good example of that, actually, for the series is Candia, which was actually a part of Chester. Chester was a much, much larger town originally, and seven towns actually broke off. Towns or part of towns broke off from Chester to become their own towns, and one of them was Candia in 1763.
Again, we're looking at the series 250 Years in the Making. It's a series that our executive producer Keith Shields has been working on all year, looking at those 13 New Hampshire towns which celebrated their 250th birthdays this year. By the way, at this point in time, I want to just read the list of names again so that folks know what towns were included and say happy birthday to them. Alstead, Candia, Croydon, Gilsum, Haverhill, Lancaster, Lisbon, New Boston, Plymouth, Sandwich, Thornton, Woodstock, and Warren. If you're from one of these towns, what did you learn from your celebrations this year? If you're from a city or town that's planning a big birthday coming up, what are your hopes for that? What might you learn from this series? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Keith, just a few minutes ago, you said the magic words that I really want to talk on, and that's railroad.
Yes.
Boy, what a big difference this made. This was boom or bust for these towns. Keith, give us a little, but I want to hear from everybody on this.
Yep, railroads made or broke towns. You know, railroads were great in certain ways because if you had a railroad that was built through your town, now you're a transportation hub. You're a place where people, you know, you could bring your agriculture into town. You could bring your lumber into town. You could bring your people into town. If the railroad passed you, sometimes that hurt you. But also, because of the railroad was invented, a lot of people left New Hampshire. That bad agricultural land, all of a sudden they realized, heck, I can go to Ohio, I can go to Indiana now that they're open, and start farming there a lot better. And so you saw a lot of population decline in these towns also because of the railroad.
Yeah, it was huge, wasn't it? Love to hear from you too, Stu. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's meant several things. Number one, it was transportation. That meant you could move goods and people. They used to like to advertise that they would annihilate distance. Actually, they annihilated time. You know, what would take a days of travel was now a few hours. What would take hours would take minutes. But in addition, it provided on the good side employment. The railroad was a big employer in the state. And in railroad centers like Rochester, Keene, Concord, Woodsville, it was a big employer. But also that employed people up and down the lines because they had to maintain the tracks, take care of the water towers and all that. And so even in towns that weren't railroad centers, there was a lot of employment. The downside is that we mentioned, you could bring in stuff from like wool from other parts of the country. It destroyed to some degree local economies. A local furniture maker couldn't compete with better capitalized furniture makers, say, in another part of the state or the region, and the railroad could start to bring in that cheaper furniture.
Boy, it sounds just like the globalization debates that we have today, doesn't it?
It is. Right. And it destroyed the local competition.
Although, Marcia, for your neck of the woods, the North Country, the White Mountains, it was great. The railroads brought in tourists by the truckload, right? Or the railroad carload.
Absolutely. But to backtrack and just mention Sandwich as another example, because Sandwich was the eighth largest town in the state in 1830. The railroad bypassed it, and that was the height of population for Sandwich because of that. But if you look at the North Country without the railroad, we would not have had the tourism that we had. So originally coming from Portland over to Gorham, they poured in all sorts of tourists. But eventually also coming up to the Plymouth area and in the long run going up to the Conway region. So it really was important for the North Country. And you'll notice that a lot of the towns that are celebrating their 250th are along a stretch that's right through the White Mountains or at the base of the White Mountains. So they were very important for us.
Well, since you mentioned Sandwich, Marcia, let's hear a little bit from Keith Series about how the railroad affected the fortunes of Sandwich.
By the mid-1800s, Sandwich took its first major hit. There was a new form of transportation shaping the state, the railroad. When officials began laying track routes up north, Marcia Schmidt Blaine says Sandwich was bypassed.
Imagine yourself as a farmer during that time. You now are going to have a much greater expense in getting your goods to market. As a matter of fact, the agricultural products coming from the Midwest cost less in Boston than goods from Sandwich. So we're looking at this town not knowing what to do at that point. They have been a major trade route, and now suddenly they're not. So that's the beginning of the big change for Sandwich.
The town needed to reinvent itself. Although the railroad had taken away Sandwich's agricultural vibrancy, residents say it left the town strikingly unspoiled. Plus, they had Squam Lake, and it was close enough to the White Mountains, and those giant farmhouses could hold a lot of people.
And so farmers began renting their bedrooms out, and they began to serve milk on a regular basis, give fresh produce. So they began to feed the tourist and house the tourist. And then gradually the tourists began buying up the lands that they were around, building new houses, buying up old farms.
Another story from Keith Shields' series this year, 250 years in the making, looking at those 13 New Hampshire towns which observed their 250th birthdays this year. We're finding out some of the stories that he uncovered and how they reflect not just those individual towns, but also the story of New Hampshire as a state. Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Galen's calling from Sandwich. Hi, Galen. Go ahead. You're on the air. Galen, are you with us? Okay. Galen, are you there? We were just talking about your town, Sandwich. I hope you're there. If not, I hope you call back, Galen. All right. Well, little technical problem with Galen there. Hopefully, Galen, will you call back? Are you there? All right. Some phone trouble with Galen. Hope you call back, Galen. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And, you know, Marcia, I want to hear from all of you on this, but you first, Marcia. I love what you folks talked about in that piece that we heard from Sandwich, because it isn't just interesting to hear about the railroad, but this theme of reinvention again and again and again. You see these New Hampshire towns going, okay, we've been knocked down, okay. Let's find something new. Let's get back up. Go ahead. I'd love your thoughts on that, and Keith, you as well.
Well, it certainly talks about New Hampshire people's resilience because they did regularly turn to new ways of working the land and how they could make a living, whether it was first farming, bringing in. One of the things to think about with farming, though, it's not just what we think of as farming, going out and plowing the land, but it involves hat making in the winter or perhaps sugaring in the spring. It's a very diversified economy. So if you lose one piece of that economy, you could replace it with tourists coming in the summer and boarding with them. And as I mentioned in that piece briefly, they had to be able to give the tourist what they wanted. And the tourist wanted what was not necessarily a real farmer's life where there was a lot of fried food, but they wanted all the fresh food. And the state actually moved in and started telling farmers, here's what you need to supply for boarders. start thinking about this. This will be a way to bring in tourists. So you see the towns reinventing themselves with some state support.
That's interesting. Yeah, and what you said about that diversified farm reminds me of that children's book by Donald Hall, Oxcart Man. Does anyone know that?
Oh, yes.
And the Oxcart Man has a farm out in somewhere in western or central New Hampshire. And once a year, he gathers all the goods and goes to Portsmouth, which is the big city. And you're right, he's diversified. He's got cabbages, he's got wool, he's got, you know, goose feathers for people to make pillows and comforters and so forth. So that's exactly it. Keith, go ahead. This theme of reinvention, it's real interesting.
Well, you know, if you're listening to the sandwich story, what happens sort of after that cutlet we display is that you find that one other way that they decided that they were going to cater to the tourists is they found that a lot of people in town, you know, were skilled in certain crafts, whether it was, you know, rug making or sweater making or wooden crafts and all that. And they said, well, you know, here are pretty well-to-do tourists who are coming up here. Why don't we sell our wares to them as well? That started an organization called the Sandwich Home Industries. And from that, we have the League of New Hampshire Craftsmen. So you can make an argument by saying that the League of New Hampshire Craftsmen might not have ever been in existence if Sandwich wasn't bypassed by the railroad. So it's these interesting things about how history, kind of how this domino effect happens and so when a historical event happens.
Marcia and then Stu.
In terms of domino effect, I think Plymouth is also a very good example. As Plymouth changed, it reinvented itself to really be a center of higher education as well as the center for our part of the state. So there are all the towns around us. We certainly are the economic center. But from 1871 on, we've also been a center for higher education, and the town depends upon the university. And so we can see that as an example of reinvention.
Yeah. Stu, you want to jump in on this? Because we keep seeing it again and again and again in the stories of these 13 towns.
Well, any community's got to, you know, make a go of it. And so you have not only towns reinventing themselves for tourism, different manufacturing enterprises, different kinds of farming, for instance, will give up on the grains and the wool, but will stick with certain fruits and vegetables, things that are perishable and don't ship well, but we've got local urban markets. And so they'll change the nature of farming, they'll get into, to some degree, mining, although we've never been a big mining state. I think sand is still our biggest resource with a few granite towns here and there. But no, they're going to reinvent themselves. And in the case of Plymouth, for instance, among other things, they got into the putting out system. The putting out system will make many towns because manufacturing could do only some of it when it came to things like socks, shoes, or in Plymouth's case, baseballs. They started to put out to local farmers and say, you've got to help us finish the product that the machine can only partially complete. And so we became a center for sporting equipment. We became a center in the Winnipesaukee Valley for making socks.
Think of New Hampshire as a center for sporting equipment.
No, the Draper Maynard Company was a huge maker of sporting equipment. It began with deerskin gloves, but it got into baseballs and bats and other stuff.
So that's in your Plymouth story, right, Keith?
That's in the Plymouth, yeah.
All right. After a short break, more of your calls, and I've got a couple emails, too, here that I want to share with you. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, what's in the new budget deal and the politics behind negotiations?
It was the week before Christmas, and in New Hampshire homes, people were shopping on tablets and phones. The connections were fine because the router's brand new, but the year-old OS is causing a stew. It's slower than jelly sliding down on the wall. In fact, it'd be faster just to go to the mall. But you could win a new iPad, says the radio chatter, with hardware that simply couldn't get any flatter. So make your donation for news, information, and more, and get in on this drawing at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Waste Management. With a reminder, new energy-efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. In Hillsborough House, a locally owned nursing facility improving the experience and delivery of rehab and residential care for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're checking out a series that's been running all year here on NHPR. It's called 250 Years in the Making. It's the stories of 13 New Hampshire towns that celebrated their 250th birthdays this year. You can read the series, check out some great pictures at nhpr.org. You can join us with your thoughts and questions now at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Keith Shields, Stuart Wallace, Marcia Schmidt-Blaine, let's go back to our listeners. Galen is back with us. Hi, Galen. Are you there this time?
Hi, Laura. I am. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're so
Sorry
welcome.
About
It's not your fault.
It's actually perfect timing that my call didn't go through. You were talking about the railroad skipping by Sandwich. And I'm 20 and been in Sandwich for 13 years now, and my family is new in the area. But one thing that's come up and been really prominent in the 250th anniversary is the return of bloodlines that go way back to the very beginning of Sandwich. And every single person, it seems, who I meet this year, or who I know was the Sandwich, has a relative who started in Sandwich at the time of Sandwich's beginning, back in the 1600s, and it shocks me that there's really no reinvention. in Sandwich, everyone is a returning member of this same family, and it's very insular. So
it's interesting, in an era when people move so much. You know, and Keith, the Sandwich story was particularly interesting to me because you talked about just what a sort of personality this community has and how close it is. I think, did you call it the Sandwich Effect even? Was there something like that?
I didn't call it that, but the person who runs the Historical Society does. And, you know, he is, you know, what he was, he called it the Sandwich Vortex, that you sort of appear in Sandwich and then you sort of find your calling. And when you hear that calling, you just go with it. And, you know, one thing I wasn't able to include in this story is that this gentleman, actually, he ended up across the street from this huge mansion owned by this old family. And there was a rumor that there was this Greek statue that had fallen apart in the 1940s. Well, they found where it was. It was behind a manure pile in an old barn.
A manure pile.
And this guy was a very crafty person, and he rebuilt this. And so if you're going in Sandwich, you'll see this very large, white, Greek Niobe statue that was rebuilt and rededicated about 2 years from this guy, you know, and he's so proud of it. And it's one of those things that he just happened to live across the street and he found out about this and he sort of found his calling.
Reminds me of the Redstone Rocket in Warren, Stu Wallace. Can you give us a quickie on that?
Well, I don't know that much about it, except that it was a guy connected to NASA, and he decided that instead of the usual cannon, plaque, bandstand
that you have downtown,
all that
right.
stuff in downtown, why not have a Redstone Rocket? And that's a real rocket. The one at the Discovery Center is not. And it's a real rocket. It stands up. People are absolutely shocked. I remember one day taking a small group of Spanish-speaking kids from Dominican Republic to the old Morse Museum in Warren, which was one of those funny, quaint private museums full of African artifacts. And I was sitting there.
Wait, I thought that shut down.
It did shut down at the time, but I've been around a long time. they haven't shut me down yet. And I remember sitting in the window, listening to the kids speaking in Spanish, looking at African artifacts, looking out the window at a Redstone rocket, and I wondered, what state am I in?
Right.
But it's there. The only problem is the maintenance of it, and every now and then they have to paint it, and I don't think you'll find rocket painters in the yellow pages. So that's
well, to say nothing of the ladder that you need to get up there.
But it is a unique entity.
It is. It's not what you're used to seeing, that white steeple and the cannon and the statue of, you know, some patriotic-looking person. No. We hiked Musilaki, my family did, earlier in the fall, and I remember driving through Warren, and one of the kids said, "Mom,
that's right.
What's that?"
You see it on the left as you go through. There it is.
Right. All right. Well, you know, earlier on we talked about this theme of reinvention, and you know, we use sandwich as an example. But boy, that's something that really I just love about this series, that these towns keep changing and reinventing who they are and how they're going to make it, no matter what happens, whether it's Go West, Young Man, or the railroads, or the Civil War, whatever. There's another town that reinvented itself from this series. That's Gilsum. I want to play their story for you, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
By the mid-20th century, the sparkle of the mines began to lose its luster. The mineral could be found more cheaply elsewhere, and many of the mines closed up. But every summer, Gilsum reclaims a little of its dazzling past at the town-hosted rock swap.
Here are your rocks. They have the labels of what they are, where they came from. And let me get your receipt.
It all traces back to Francis Bunk Maloney. The former town postmaster and miner was an avid rock collector. In 1964, he came up with an idea of a fundraiser where other mineral collectors would come for a rock swap. Rob Mitchell's the current president of the Gilsum Recreation Committee that puts on the Swap and Mineral Show.
You had this real interest in the late 60s and the 70s in mineral collecting, and there were all these clubs all over the country that would do these swaps. And they started flocking here, and by the mid-70s, there were 10,000 people coming to this little town, all meeting up on this field to trade minerals.
Again, that's a piece from Keith Shields' series, 250 Years in the Making. So there you have it, Marcia. Yet again, a town saying, all right, well, things aren't quite working out the way we had hoped. Things are changing. Let's adapt. Another town in modern times that strikes me, I think it's the area around Loon Mountain. They have the Highland Games now. So it's a big event, you know, and who knew?
It's a huge event. I think a good example of way that New Hampshireites are able to figure out, well, we don't want to leave. And I think that's one of the things that people need to think about. They don't want to leave this area, so how can they stay? Well, that's when you start reinventing. That's when you try to find that rock swap, or you find Loon Mountain. And if you're lucky enough to have somebody like Sherm Adams around to be able to get it going, then you've got what you need to be able to stay in the area.
Yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Well, you know, what I loved about Gilsum is that, you know, Alsted, which is actually one town over, was also a large mining town as well. And between those towns and you know, one or two maybe around them, I mean, it really led the country at one point in time in the microproduction. It produced a lot of beryllium. It produced, you know, rocks like that. But, you know, Alsted, you wouldn't really know it when you go through the town. But Gilsum, they really kind of owned that rock way about them. You know, it's Gilsum Rocks. That's what the theme of their 250th anniversary was. They have this shirt that says, "May the quartz be with you." They have their war memorial. You know, every town has those, has a war memorial. But their war memorial is kind of bedazzled by all these rocks and gems that you find in the area. Quartz, you know, red quartz and the beryllium and the mica and all that. It's really interesting, and that's what I love about it. They've owned this idea of being the rock town. And in the story in the very beginning, it was this woman who moved here and was just so excited because she loves stones, and now she says that she's in the stone capital of America.
Well, and that's the other thing that strikes me about this series, and I'd love your thoughts on this, Stu Wallace, is that in some of these stories, it's really just, you know, like he said, it's one person or it's a group, a small group of people who have the energy and the passion. They say, yeah, let's do this. You see that time and time and again.
Well, you take advantage of what you've got. And in the case of New Hampshire, we have a massive quantity of different minerals. Mineral people will tell you almost everything is here. It's just not in very big quantities. And so a Ruggles Mine or a Gilsum will take advantage of that. But also it's a case of finding the key individual. We mentioned the Sandwich Home Industries in the beginning of the league. That was partly the Coolidge family, but also partly a small-time silversmith and camp director named A. Cooper Ballantyne, who got together and between the Coolidge family and Ballantyne came up with this whole new thing, this home industries and this the League of New Hampshire Craftsmen. It takes an entrepreneur like that to come along and say, I've got the passion to make it work. And others will scoff and say it won't. But yeah, if you've got the passion to carry it through, it does.
Let's take another call if we could. This is Tracy waiting in Peterborough. Tracy, you've been hanging on for a while. Thanks for being so patient. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. I've greatly enjoyed Keith's series and the insights from the wonderful guest this morning. Thank you. It appears there are 10 more towns that will be celebrating their 250th anniversaries in 2014, and I was wondering if there are plans to continue your series.
Okay, Keith, so more work. That's a great question,
Tracy. The short answer is yes, definitely. You know, one of the interesting things, you know, I actually have not looked too closely into it. We are continuing the series. I counted 12, but this is one of the really interesting things about this series and probably one of the biggest challenges. And Stu and Marcia can talk about this as well. It's when does a town become a town? Because back in 1763, 1764, becoming a town was a three-part process: the granting, the incorporation, and the settling. And then if you didn't sort of do all this in a certain amount of time, you lost the grant. And this happened in many of these towns.
I see. So you had to move on this. You couldn't just
You had
hang
to move.
Out.
You had to do it within a certain amount of time or you lost the grant. And this happened. New Boston it happened to. It happened to in Woodstock. It happened to in Thornton. But certain towns say, you know, that day one when in 1763 when we got that grant, that is day one. Other ones say, well, you know, it actually was when we were incorporated. You know, sometimes it was an incorporation and a settling in one day. Sometimes, you know, it took a year to do that. So every town is interpreted when it actually first becomes a town. So one of the things is that you will that I'm going to do Lancaster actually in early 2014 because even though 1763 is when it began, they're celebrating in 2014 because they think that 1764 is their first day.
I see.
It really is, and actually Croydon looks, you know, 3 years down the road as well. So it's a really interesting thing. It was a long process about when a town became a town, and so how they interpret it is really up to the townspeople.
Well, it's a great question, Tracy. Thank you for calling in. And here's an email from Colleen in Ackworth, and I think this is for you as well, Keith. Colleen says, "Will this series be made into a book? I would love to have that wonderful reference at my fingertips. Could be good for fundraising." Thanks for the email, Colleen.
I think it's a great idea. You know, we'll have to look into that. But yeah, I would love to do that. That sounds great.
One theme that came up again in all these stories, and you guys have all touched on it, but I want to talk about it a little bit more. And to you, Marcia, how excited and proud people were to celebrate these anniversaries. You know, how much it meant to them to do this. What sort of a feeling did local people get this year from observing this milestone? Your town, where you work anyway, I'm not sure if you live in Plymouth, but you work in Plymouth, they went all out in Plymouth.
Oh, yes. And I do live in Plymouth, so as does Stu. Plymouth started working on this 3 years ago, and we were really pushed forward by the president of the Plymouth Historical Society, Lisa Lundari, and without her it would not have happened. But what she did and what ultimately the crew did that was working with her is they planned a week-long celebration from birthday cake to, what do you call that stuff, bubble snow, I guess you could call it, for the little kids, to parade, and really a spectacular parade. It was just full of things to do, with a lot of things happening on one particular weekend, as well as, of course, we also had a play that was written by Manuel Marcus Sterling and Trish Lindberg on the founding and the development of Plymouth as a town.
A full two-hour musical production, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we went all out.
Well,
it was fabulous.
I want to play a little bit of that for folks and then talk to the rest of you about Plymouth. Yeah, go ahead. Again, that's a musical, a two-hour full-fledged musical that your town, Stu Wallace, put on to celebrate its 250th birthday. Wow. What did it mean to folks to observe this? It seems like in a lot of the stories Keith did, people got really jazzed about it.
I think that if nothing else, it, among other things, it promotes an interest in history, which is always a good thing.
Speaking as a historian.
Right, speaking as a historian. And it does, because people, I think, often take their history for granted. And I think as a country, we as a whole tend to pay more lip service and actually read our character and ourselves into our history. But it does mean a big thing. I've been a part of a number of towns and part of the state when they've gone through a variety of celebrations. I was living in Dover when they did their 300th at that time. And And speaking of that, we're actually looking in 10 years at the 300th of the state's first settlement. Who knows what's going to happen there?
Wow.
But we are big on anniversaries. And if nothing else, for the first time, it gets people to stop and say, well, it isn't just the headlines in the newspaper that matters. There's a reason we're here. There's a tradition. There's a reason who we are.
Yeah, Marcia and then Keith.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. It is our identity. And without an understanding of where you've come from, you can't know where you're going or who you are. So the identity of the town, the state, really does rest on understanding the history.
Yeah, were there some towns, Keith, where this 250th was less of a big deal? I'm sure every town celebrated in its own way, but...
I wouldn't say less of a big deal, but it was sort of lessly done. You know, Thornton, it was just incorporated into their Old Home Day celebration. You know, other towns, you know, they were kind of just maybe a small week of activities. But other towns, just as Sue and Marcia said, it was blown up, a year-long celebration. I love the story about Haverhill because, yeah, we talked about these really distinct and independent towns. But people said that the 250th anniversary, first of all, they had people from each one of these communities as a part of the celebration, along with Newbury, Vermont, which actually has a whole bunch of, you know, places of their own, a whole bunch of sections of their own. They really brought them together, and that's one of the great things. I mean, there were license plates, there were time capsules, there were T-shirts, there were Christmas ornaments, there were commemorative coins that were made, there were books that were made for these anniversaries, you know, big honking books that were made for the anniversary. It was so great. And I have to say, one of the things, I grew up in a town and I couldn't wait to get out of it when I was 18 years old and, you know, and kind of felt bad for the people who lived in town. But when I started talking to these people who lived in town 70, 80, I got very jealous of them because, you know, there is a real connection between them and the town. And I just really was so inspired by them.
Yeah. And is your Christmas tree decorated with some of these ornaments, Keith?
Right now at the desk, but yeah. There's actually, I'm going to have a little collage of little mementos I got for the year.
Oh, it's great. Well, I want to let everybody know you can read the series if you didn't hear it. You can look at some really awesome pictures, nhpr.org. Again, the series is called 250 Years in the Making. Keith Shields, Stu Wallace, Marcia Schmidt-Blaine, thank you very much all for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to go out with more from the song that folks in Plymouth produced to celebrate their 250th birthday. It's called Marking the Moment. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineers, Dan Colgan, producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns, Nate Graby. The executive producer is Keith Shields. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. There are just hours left to enter NHPR's drawing to win a new iPad Air. When you make your gift to NHPR, of course, we'll put your name in the hat, but we'll also use your gift to help us pay for your favorite programs.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
Give us a call, make a gift, and enter to win at nhpr.org.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and A&E Coffee Roastery and Teas, holiday gifts, fresh roasted organic coffees and whole leaf teas, and organic fair trade coffee from Tarazu, Costa Rica. Carriage Depot Plaza, Route 101A, Amherst. And Granite State College Office of Graduate Studies, flexible schedules, faculty of expert practitioners, and curriculum focused on individual student goals. More at granite.edu/NHPR.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a budget bill which eases the impact of sequestration, and it would prevent another government shutdown. This week, the Senate is expected to take it up, even though